Thank you, Dr. Paolucci. Dr. Paolucci was talking about wolves and lions and so forth, and there's an Italian saying which goes somewhat along the lines of, make yourselves sheep and the wolves will eat you, so that we can't be sheep. The next speaker, what was that, Frank? No, that's the wrong one. I had these in another order, but then Frank Meyer decided he wanted to speak last.
It's a slander.
He's always making it difficult. We in ISI don't really have any ethnic hang-ups in a way. Frank Schoderoff told me one time that he said we had an Irish president, Bill Buckley, and he said then we had a Jewish president. We thought that now it would be time for an Italian, and I want you to groom a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant to follow you. So we take advantage of that. Dr. Herberg is the graduate professor of philosophy and culture at Drew University. Received his BA, MA, and PhD from Columbia University. It's too bad he didn't get a BS, because I could have told you a little joke. But in addition, he holds honorary degrees from Park College, Franklin and Marshall College, and Ohio Wesleyan University. Dr. Herberg is well known for, you said more?
Never mind.
I wasn't even going to read all of this. Dr. Herberg is well known for his work in two fields, social philosophy and theology. He's the author of Judaism and Modern Man, an interpretation of Jewish religion. The author of Protestant Catholic Jew, an essay in American religious sociology. And has edited the writings of Martin Buber, four existentialist theologians, Community, State, and Church, three essays by Karl Barth. In addition to writing for various reviews and journals, he has published three monographs: The Jewish Labor Movement in America, The Political Theory of American Marxism, Religion and Education in America. His recent articles, appearing in the Intercollegiate Review, have been widely circulated by the Wall Street Journal, United Press International, other nationally known publications. We had to take the advantage to put in a little bit of a plug.
Thank you.
What is the state of the conservative movement in this country today? What is the future of conservatism in America? I have some ideas on this question, which is of such absorbing interest to all of us. And these ideas I should like to place before you for consideration and comment. In a word, what I should like to do is to assess, so far as I'm able, the resources and possibilities, the strengths and the weaknesses of conservatism in America today. Conservatism today confronts us in this country on several levels and leads us in several directions. Most fundamental, I should say, is what I would call value conservatism, the basic moral, social, and cultural attitudes of the people. As far as the masses of the American people are concerned, there is as no question whatever, but are these are thoroughly conservative attitudes, sometimes recognized as such, sometimes even named as such. I'll display some of the evidence for this generalization in a few minutes. At the other end of the spectrum is philosophical conservatism, the conservatism of those who hold their conservative views as a well-considered and consciously articulated social and political philosophy. We, by our very presence here, express and exemplify this kind of conservatism. And there is, of course, the political conservatism, in the narrowest sense of the term, the conservatism that shows itself in voting patterns and other forms of political behavior. This, I think, is probably the most perplexing aspect of conservatism in America today. Let us look a little more closely at conservatism on each of these levels. First, the basic mass conservatism of the American people. I'm speaking here of what is nowadays known as middle America, the blue-collar respectables, the white-collar respectables, and the farmers. The evidence of their conservatism is massive and hardly disputed. The liberals refer to it as a deplorable backwardness of the American people. I have other words for that. Here is some of the evidence. The Lewis Harris survey in December 1968 and another one 1970. Now, Lewis Harris is not predisposed to favor the conservative direction, but he's a conscientious and scientific surveyor. You ask the American people, how do they consider themselves? Conservative, middle of the road, liberal, or radical? And you define this a little more closely. If you favor the establishment, you are conservative, middle of the road, and perhaps liberal. If you're against the establishment, thoroughly and entirely, you're radical. Here are the results. 38% of the American people said they're conservative by name. 32% middle of the road. Liberal, 17%. Radical, 2%. Not sure, 13%. Well, that's not a high proportion. You confront an ordinary man and ask him what he is, conservative, liberal. He hasn't thought about it at all. You hardly expect him to, right off the bat, to tell you. It's not a high proportion. I'm defending the American people, you understand. Yankelevich survey in New York State, which is supposed to be the hotbed of liberalism or something of the sort, got exactly the same results. 34.8% conservative, 26% middle of the road, 26.8%, and 22% liberal, of whom you must allow a certain amount that are radical. He didn't take radical in his categories. The Gallup poll in April 1970 found 52% of the American people saying they're conservative, 34% saying they're liberal. I want you to remember these figures. They are the best evidence we have available of the moral, social, and political attitudes of the American people. Now we have something more interesting. Well, not more interesting, at least it's interesting. There are two vacancies on the Supreme Court. In April 1970, Gallup asked the American people, should Supreme Court appointments go to conservatives or to liberals? Fair question. 49% conservatives, 27% liberals, 24% no opinion. Almost twice as many conservative people who said that the appointees to the Supreme Court should be conservatives. Now, I have massive evidence in another folder. I'm not going to bother you with it. But I think it's perfectly clear that this basic value conservatism, some people call it instinctive conservatism. I doubt the word instinctive is proper. Value conservatism of the American people is definitely there on a massive scale. I don't think there can be any real question. The masses of the American people are conservative in their outlook. And nowadays, often ready to call themselves conservatives, because these surveys were taken on the categories explicitly saying conservative, liberal, or middle of the road. Now, philosophical conservatism. Conservatism, held as a social and political philosophy, is enjoying a boom or revival, if you go back before the Civil War, a boom or revival without precedent in many decades. Surely I don't have to tell you that. You know it better than anyone else. Less than a quarter of a century ago, conservatism was a term practically unknown in American politics. Senator Taft called himself a good liberal, that's all. And if you ever use the word conservative, if anybody ever knew the meaning of the word, it referred to something in English politics, that's all. But now, conservative is everywhere. I should say that in some circles today, there is real danger of conservatism becoming, well, what do I call it? Trendy, chic. You know, you have chic. You remember chic, radical chic? We may live to see the day when you have conservative chic. A fate worse than death. Bill Buckley was certainly right when, as far back as 3 years ago, he called attention to what was happening. He said, for the past few years, he said, he's writing in January 1968, any number of ideas developed in the garrets of conservative scriveners and roughly dismissed as radical or irrelevant have suddenly begun to appear in the classiest political shop windows. It will be easy to show without any difficulty. And I've drawn up such a list for my own academic purposes, which Bill Buckley put in one of his columns. He always does anyway. How rapidly liberal orthodoxies in any number of fields are crumbling, and the corresponding conservative positions are being strengthened. Just about a century ago, John Stuart Mill called the Tories the stupid party. And vaunted the liberals as the intelligent ones. Today, it is the liberals who are the stupid party, endlessly chewing on the straw of their tired old slogans. And the conservatives who show the fresh and challenging intelligence. A number of certified liberals I could mention, but I won't, have sadly and with much head-shaking admitted this to me. I could mention, oh, you all know them, but I won't mention them. Personal confidences, you know. Now, let me repeat. Not only are the conservatives becoming the intelligent party today, but there is a marked movement of intellectuals well-known for their creative thinking and scholarship toward the conservative positions, even to the point of identifying themselves as conservatives. Dr. Pagliucci mentioned Nathan Glaser. He wrote a letter to Bill Buckley. Did you see that letter? A few months ago, where he apologized to Bill for having been nasty to him in earlier writings. In the end, he says, I find myself, from being a moderate liberal, I've become a moderate conservative. He uses that, and on Harvard campus, he's constantly known as a conservative. As a conservative, he calls himself a conservative. I'm pleased at that. He's an old friend of mine. And I like my friends, you know. And I don't have to mention only Nat Glaser. You go all along the line. Acquaintance. Not only Nisbet or Banfield on the West Coast and in Harvard, but Moynihan, Kissinger, also friends of mine, Nathan Glaser, Irving Kristol, Seymour Martin Lipset, and so on and on and on. Now, the American Jewish Committee, not the Congress, had a conference about 2 months ago of Jewish conservatives, something that 10 years ago was impossible to find. You'd have to have an anthropological expedition to find them. But there were 75 there from all over the country. The West Coast, Berman, he wrote American in the 60s, a classic book. Berman and Columbia. And everywhere, every campus on the West Coast, every campus on the East Coast, and some in between, Chicago and the others. They were amazed. Jewish conservatives. I won't go into that. And Seymour Martin Lipset and I were co-chairmen. Seymour Martin Lipset is one of the best sociologists in the country at Harvard. I take up the championship of Harvard now. Some of my best friends are at Harvard. Now, this seems to me a very welcome trend. But I'm appalled at how many of my conservative friends prefer to deny this and picture themselves as a tiny group of embattled warriors holding forth against the advancing hordes of liberal barbarians. They love the notion of being a tiny minority, that a superior virtue and blessedness of being a tiny minority. Well, maybe there is, but heroic posture, perhaps, but utterly unrealistic and bound to be proved self-defeating. The trend is with us today, intellectually. The voting business I'll take up a little later, but the trend is with us today intellectually. I could spend an hour detailing point by point. The reality is that intellectually, at least, the trend is all with us. It is the conservatives who are doing the fresh and significant thinking in every field. And even our opponents are coming to recognize it. And the opponent of yesterday may be a friend of today, as Augustine said about those outside the church and in the church, remember? Those who are outside the church today may be found the city of God at the end, and vice versa. So those who are liberals today may be conservatives tomorrow. So don't try. You ought to remember the New Testament parable of the sheep and the goats. Don't try to weed them out, the wheat and the tares. Don't try to weed them out too soon, too prematurely. We should welcome those who show signs of moving. Well, I shouldn't go this way, to the right. Now, the question arises, well, if this is so, if the mass of American people are conservative-minded and don't mind saying so, if conservatives are pointing the way intellectually, why doesn't all this show up in election results? For we all know that it is the liberals and the half-liberals who get themselves elected mostly in state and nation. Why is this so? Because, and this is a lesson we all ought to learn fast, voting behavior is not determined simply or even primarily by ideology or what we would call political philosophy. There are a number of very important, often decisive, non-ideological factors in voting behavior. Of this, more later. Now, what is it in conservatism, in conservative values and conservative attitudes that so appeals to the American people? Some of these points come to mind immediately. Let me repeat them. They're very first, there is stability. The conservative emphasis on stability, on steadiness, on continuity, as against a liberal passion for innovation, for feverish change. For the liberals, nothing ever stays put. Then there is the conservative emphasis on self-help, on letting people alone, giving them a chance to help themselves, as against a liberal itch for governmental interference, always passing laws on everything. And third, there is the conservative insistence on the old traditional work ethic, the ethic that values work as a substance of man's life, and that insists, in St. Paul's words, that if they will not work, they shall not eat, Thessalonians. A liberal welfareism, the liberal position is associated with wild spending, liberal welfareism, where working people are forced to support welfare beneficiaries who won't work and who regarded such support without work as somehow their right, a human right. But perhaps the most popular conservative emphasis is the emphasis on law and order. The appeal to get tough with disorder and violence on the streets, no matter what cover or pretext. the resentment that is felt by massive Americans against the way the courts have been crippling the hand of law enforcement. There is a revulsion against the liberal tendency to find idealistic excuses for violence and disorder, to protect criminals, to hamper law enforcement. Finally, there is the conservative patriotism, pro-Americanism, undying hostility to communism that so appeals to the mass of Americans. Where liberals are seen as soft on communism, embarrassed at patriotism, ashamed of America. Now, all of these conservative attitudes are wrapped up in an all-enveloping, generalized, Lockean, old-line liberalism. Dr. Pagliucci mentioned that. It's true, which is the public philosophy expressed in the preamble of the Declaration of Independence, a public philosophy shared by virtually all Americans, without exception. Some exception, myself, for example. But this old-line Lockean liberalism is not felt to be liberalism at all by the mass of Americans, as indeed it is not, if we mean by liberalism, the present-day welfare liberalism, to which the mass of Americans are vehemently opposed. Now, what is the impact of these appeals on the various strata of the American people? Undoubtedly, the workers of this country are overwhelmingly conservative in underlying attitude and outlook. Black workers, as well as white. But in their political behavior, American workers are drastically hampered from expressing their conservatism by powerful political ties formed on other grounds. Let me illustrate this. Right after the Civil War, the Republican Party was riding high, wide, and handsome. The Democratic Party was shattered because it had been, copperhead. It had been mildly or strongly pro-Southern. In New England, the Republican Party was a Yankee Protestant establishment. Hordes of Irish came in. And after the Irish, the Italians, and after the Italians, the Poles. The leader of the Republican Party, the spokesman of the old Yankee stock, looked upon these characters as barbarians. They called them that. I have the documentation. You know what happened in Boston? I have I bought an antique shop, a plaque on the public parks, government parks. Dogs and Irish keep out. And somebody asked, I think, I won't mention who, said it must be the Irish because dogs can't read. The riposte to this was the Irish couldn't read either. The Republicans didn't want them. They were not Yankees and they were not Protestants. They were foreigners and they were Catholics, imagine. But the Democratic Party saw a chance of growth, or at least a survival, and welcomed them. And there was formed a firm and almost indestructible tie, not entirely indestructible, between the ethnics of the new immigration, the Irish, the Italians and the Poles, massively, and the Democratic Party. Now, this has nothing to do with ideology, absolutely nothing. I want to show you how you remember the Civilian Review Board referendum in New York City? You ought to remember it. All the liberals were on the side of a Civilian Review Board. The only ones against it, I think, who spoke were Bill Buckley. I don't remember anybody else. The population of New York voted 2.5-1 against it. And I know the people there. I asked an Irish Catholic, he was a taxi driver upper city. And I asked him, look, that's how you voted. You elect Democrats who vote in the opposite direction, who vote for policies abhorrent to your heart. Why do you vote for them? He looked at me sternly and said, well, we're a Democratic family, aren't we? It's just as difficult to pry them loose, it seems, from the Democratic Party as a mother church. But they're being pried loose. But you understand what I mean by non-ideological factors. There's a whole list of them. But that's an example. That's the most important. Now, Now the farmers. I'm listing, you know, I'm assessing the impact on the various strata of the population. The farmers, they are overwhelmingly conservative in attitude and outlook. But, and this is not unimportant, there are still lingering traces of populism among them from the 1870s, 80s, 90s, all along, which often works mischief politically. What can we say about the business class, which is our present-day American elite? The situation is much more complicated. The business class is typically associated with an old line, laissez-faire Lockean liberalism, which they take to be the proper conservatism. But businessmen, by the very nature of their professional activities, often have a strong itch for innovation. Innovation is the law of their life. You've got to get ahead, a new thing, new, which is the very opposite of conservatism. For American businessmen, the word revolution, believe it or not, the word revolution is an okay word, you know what I mean, a good word. Let me show you. Here's revolution, you see here? The word revolution on top? And it's a paean of praise for revolution. A paean of praise for revolutionist. It's revolutionist. You know what that is? An ad for tires. The word revolution is a popular word with businessmen. They want change constantly, technologically, business procedures. They want change. And that old settled ways, custom, tradition, are looked upon with distaste by the progressive modern businessman who is so fascinated by the innovating spirit of modern technology. Of course, businessmen are concerned about protecting and preserving their interests against attack. But so is every special interest group in our society, even the professors. But it has nothing to do with their conservatism or liberalism. There's a real problem there with the business class. And those who act in a conservative movement will know that. But it's the suburban middle class that seems most vulnerable to left liberal infection. A segment of the suburban middle class, not too large, but neither is it entirely insignificant, is particularly vulnerable to mod, way out influences. You understand the language I'm using, mod, way out influences. Undermining traditional standards of morality, decency, and politics, engendering a significant left liberal element in culture and political life. Intellectuals today are very largely, but by no means entirely, identified with a new status bureaucratic liberalism, what I call welfare liberalism. And yet, the same intelligentsia, even the academic intelligentsia, is already beginning to produce a small but significant conservative segment, giving body to the new philosophical conservatism. On the other side, the extreme left liberal intellectuals have been helping to develop a kind of vaguely defined counterculture, a loose system of ideas and values, of habits and ways of life and behavior, challenging our moral and cultural tradition, sometimes in a head-on collision. But I'm glad to note that the counterculture, with its erosions and corrosions of everything worthwhile, is already beginning to crumble. There are definite signs of returning health among these elements, especially the student youth, who would seem to have been most affected by the putridities of the counterculture. Now, the picture is a very uneven one, but it is overwhelmingly on the conservative side. Why then should such a discrepant record of voting behavior? This is a fascinating subject, which has only recently begun receiving scholarly attention, although the practitioners of politics, like Dick Daley of Chicago, the most eminent practitioner of politics in this country, a lot to learn from him. I spent a week interviewing him and studying the whole Chicago situation. You learn a lot about practical politics from there. The practitioners of politics, the political bosses, have always known the facts of life. Or they say in the language that I'm referring to, they know where the bodies are buried.
And they vote them.
It would take me too far too long to make an adequate examination of these so-called non-ideological factors of the in voting, of the forces that more directly and immediately affect voting behavior. I'll merely mention some of them just by naming them that have loomed large in recent studies. Historical memory, on which I have already said something, entrenched family tradition, ethnic background, religious belonging, regional alignments, class, cultural position, special group advantage, and the public image of candidates. If you want to understand how politics works, study how Procaccino conducted his campaign in the mayoralty election. His image, pictorially, is not attractive. He's not a handsome man like John Lindsay. No. But that is not the image I mean. You know what he did? When City College was closed down, you remember? He had a court order and stood at the gates waving the court order, "I will open up City College," and he did. That's an image. And it worked wonderfully. The picture of Procaccino as a conservative Democrat. It worked perfectly. Well, things do not remain fixed forever, not even in politics. The apparently unbreakable bonds that have tied the ethnic groups, especially the ethnic labor groups, to the Democratic Party with its liberal face are beginning. That's a real basis for the so-called New Deal coalition, you know. They're beginning to crumble. I have the figures on the mayoralty election in New York in 1969. A majority of the Irish voted for Markey. Unbelievable. For a Republican. It's like a good, faithful Catholic patronizing the Protestant Church. It's unbelievable that a majority of the Irish voted for Markey. A majority of the Italians voted for Procaccino or Markey. 49% of the Jews voted for Procaccino and about 15% for Markey. You know what that means? It's unbelievable. And so on. The only ones who voted solidly, almost solidly, for Lindsay were the Puerto Ricans and the blacks. Nobody else in the whole city. There's a large enough element in the city to give a considerable advance to his election. But we're analyzing the different groups. Now let me summarize. And this is not only true of New York, of course. We have Philadelphia, Rizzo, those from that area will remember. Rizzo, Boston, Los Angeles. And there's much promise in these developments. Let me summarize now and bring to focus these somewhat scattered remarks I've been making on the future of conservatism in America. First, liberalism today is everywhere in retreat, in disarray, in disintegration. Conservatism as a value system, articulating an entrenched way of life, is overwhelmingly dominant among the American people. Conservatism as a political philosophy has been enjoying a notable upsurge in prestige and influence in the past 2 years, in the past 2 decades, not 2 years, 2 decades. And since Bill Buckley is not here, I can well say that he played a big role in this upsurge, tremendous role. He's one of the best stylists in English. I think he's the best English stylist in America since Evelyn Waugh, or in English language since Evelyn Waugh, a magnificent stylist. And that's a good entry. I have some graduate students who came, you know, Southern liberals. The worst kind of liberal is a Southern liberal. I get them to read Bill Buckley just as an exercise in literature or something. And merely the style and the play of ideas has a big influence on them. I never preach to them, but they end up as good old conservatives. Now, the problem remains how to translate this conservatism as an entrenched way of life and as a political philosophy into voting behavior, into political electoral power. That's the problem. It's a problem that can be solved only in realistic practice. No anticipatory intellectual formula will solve it. You solve it only ambulando, in practice. But perhaps it will not come amiss to take heart from the testimony of a political heathen that is a liberal. Here are the words. A time of perplexity creates a need for somber and tragic interpretations of man. Thus we find Burke more satisfying than Paine, Edmund Burke and Tom Paine. Hamilton or Adams more satisfying than Jefferson. Calhoun more satisfying than Webster or Clay. Conservatism, in its true sense, more satisfying than liberalism as we have known it in the past century and a half. Do you know who said that? Arthur M. Schlesinger, Jr. They always say that to bring testimony of heathen is the best evidence for Christianity. Well, the bring the testimony of liberals is the best evidence for conservatism. Arthur M. Schlesinger, Jr. said that. So let us take heart. The future is still ours to make. Thank you.